John Fia is a historian at Messiah College and a self-identifying evangelical Christian who recently wrote the book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. This is John Fia. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with Professor John Fia. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Duncan.
So you are a self-identified evangelical Christian, but unlike many evangelicals, you clearly have a problem with the current president, and you've written a book about it called Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Trump. First off, why write this book?
Yeah, great question. I blogged. So I have a blog that gets a significant following among American evangelicals, mostly, you know, thoughtful evangelicals, pastors, those kinds of people. And I'm very interested in religion and politics. Most of my books that I've written, this book is my sixth. Most of my previous books intersected with religion and politics in one way or another. So I was following the 2016 primary season very closely. You know, Trump kind of emerged. So I had been sort of blogging my way through the election at thewayofimprovementleadshome.com, thewayofimprovement.com, which is my blog. And I've been writing a lot of different op-eds and so forth regarding the election. So when Erdman's Publishing approached me with the opportunity to write a book about Trump, it was actually pretty easy because I had already thought through a lot of these questions. Now, that's the kind of pragmatic, logistical side of why I chose to write the book. The other reason I wanted to write the book was I wanted to, number one, provide some arguments to my fellow evangelicals that Donald Trump may not have been the best decision for them in 2016, and make a case for the engagement of religion and politics, or at least evangelicalism and politics, that was quite different than what the Christian right had to offer. And I think it was the Christian right view that was largely driving the support of Donald Trump in 2016. But then as a historian, I wanted to take a deeper look. I wanted to trace these categories of things like fear and nostalgia and power, these kinds of things that have informed evangelical political life for a long time. And I wanted to trace them deeper into American history and kind of see how 81% of evangelicals in 2016 ended up voting for Trump. In other words, what were the historical forces that were shaping the way people were voting, or at least the way evangelicals were voting in 2016? So that's the short story, but that's the background behind why I decided to write Believe Me.
Right. So let's explore those forces. You identify in your book three predominant themes that can help explain why there's been a rise of Trump-friendly Christians. And the three you identify are basically fear, power, and nostalgia. And I was hoping we could walk through those three.
Sure.
Let's start with fear. You have a chapter in your book called A Short History of Evangelical Fear. And you go all the way back to the Puritans, who were some of the first Europeans to make a home here. Why did you feel the need to go that far back?
Well, again, part of it is just my the way I think about the world. I am a historian. Things don't just happen. Like 2016 just doesn't happen in a vacuum. We need to think about bigger arcs, bigger, larger trajectories of how we got to the place where we are today. Now, some historians might trace this back to like the 1970s. I do too in my book, or maybe after World War II, or maybe the 1960s and the Christian right reaction to the culture of the 1960s may have led them to think about politics in a different way. But as I began to dig deeper into the American past, I noticed that there were examples dating all the way back to the 17th century, when evangelical Christians had a choice to respond to their changing demographic circumstances or their changing culture, they had a choice to respond with fear or with some level of what I call hope. And almost inevitably, whenever the culture changes in a way that moves away from some kind of evangelical Christian consensus, evangelicals have responded with fear and have cultivated, for lack of a better term, a kind of politics of fear. I think you can see this with, say, even as far back as the Salem witch trials. You know, this great fear that the so-called city on a hill that the Puritans were trying to found was now coming under attack by the British, by royal governors, even by Satan himself. And they responded with this awful hanging of witches in the town of Salem, Massachusetts. So that's just one small example, but I traced this throughout. And I think you can draw a straight line. There's a kind of continuity there. Excuse me. Between demographic change and evangelicals responding with this kind of politics of fear.
Well, when you say demographic change, what kind of demographic change are you talking about?
Sure. You know, I think in the 17th century in New England, you see more than just Puritans are moving into the colony. The Puritan colony wanted to be established as a pure Puritan society, right? That was a homogeneous society where the laws of the Bible as understood by the Puritans informed the law. And then you have all these other settlers coming in who don't share that religious conviction. I think this causes anxiety. I'm thinking about in the early 19th century, when Catholics start coming into the country in droves, and you see these so-called nativist movements to prevent Catholic immigration. Much of it is driven by fear that these Catholic immigrants are somehow going to water down or undermine the Protestant nation that many evangelicals had hoped to build in the early 19th century. I think you see, and just fast forwarding, I think you see it even today, where as we become a more pluralistic society, as white Christians begin to move towards minority status in this country, there's a great deal of anxiety that comes up, which causes people to turn to the politics of fear. And usually the politics of fear is associated with turning to some kind of a political strongman in some ways to protect them against these forces of change, these demographic changes.
Mm. You write in your book that in a sin-cursed world, we should expect anxiety-induced emotions to rise in response to social change. Do you think, though, when we're talking about these fears, do you think that these fears are misplaced, or do you think that they just haven't been handled in a healthy way?
Yeah, fear is an interesting category for historical analysis. And here I'm drawing from a recent trend in the field of history known as the history of emotions, in which historians are writing really interesting books about things like hate and jealousy and homesickness and, you know, a bunch of other kind of emotions that we feel. Fear is, I believe, because I'm an evangelical Christian, and as you mentioned, we live in a broken world, fear is inevitable. We are all going to be fearful people. And I also think there are people who don't share my faith who are fearful. You hear a lot of people sort of on the left saying, you know, well, if this happens or that happens with Donald Trump, it'll be the end of democracy. Or if we don't get Trump out of office now, this and this and this is going to happen. So be afraid, be very afraid. I don't hold non-Christians to the same kind of standards about fear that I do. I think we're all fearful. But my faith tells me, and I think the faith of Christianity in general says, that we are to fear not. Perfect love casts out fear. The novelist Marilyn Robinson, the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, once said, fear is not a Christian habit of mind. So, yes, we're afraid. Yes, we get fearful of the way our culture is moving. But I think it's very unhealthy and unchristian to build an entire political philosophy around the idea of fear, which essentially results in us trying to reclaim and renew some kind of a Christian culture that we believe is lost. And we're very fearful that somehow God is going to stop blessing the United States if we continue to go down these roads. I think fear is not a Christian habit of mind. So I'm writing this book in many ways to my fellow evangelicals to try to say, you know, is fear really the best kind of emotion or even the best kind of idea to build a political philosophy around? And what I try to do in the book is I try to trace the kind of fear mongering that went on through the 2016 election, trying to get evangelicals afraid that the country or the republic or the moral character of the country is falling off a cliff. And unless we elect Donald Trump, or unless we get a president who's going to appoint the right Supreme Court justices, everything's going to go to hell. Now, you know, to me, that kind of fear mongering is not a very good posture for evangelicals to engage in or with.
Let's talk about the second theme, which is power. From my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jimmy Carter was the first president who ran explicitly and openly as a born-again Christian. Do you think that started the trend in this country of seeing the evangelical community not just as a community of faith, but as a potential voting bloc?
Yeah. I think Jimmy Carter you're right to suggest that he's the first president to run explicitly as a born-again Christian. I mean, there have been other presidents, obviously, who were Christian and made a big deal of Christian faith, but no one kind of used that term born again in the way that Jimmy Carter did. We can have a debate over whether or not Jimmy Carter saw himself as a particular Christian candidate, or if he was advancing some kind of Christian agenda in his politics. There's some good evidence to support that. There's some not so good evidence. He was he may have just been a Democratic candidate who happened to be a born again Christian. Again, we can debate that, but I do think Carter sets the ball rolling in the sense that the reaction to Carter was very, very strong by conservatives and Republicans at first, and evangelicals. At first, many evangelicals embraced Jimmy Carter. They loved the idea that one of their own, a Southern Baptist evangelical, or at least self-professed evangelical, was running for president. And they thought that Jimmy Carter would be very influential in advancing, say, the overturning of Roe versus Wade or religious liberty for segregated schools in the South and so forth. But when Jimmy Carter did not deliver on these things, or at least had a different Christian political philosophy about these things than people like, say, Jerry Falwell Sr. or the members of the Moral Majority, as they were known, many evangelicals led by Falwell Sr. turned against Jimmy Carter. And by the end of Carter's campaign, or I should say first term, his only term, you began to see a political coalition emerging of evangelical born-again Christians to try to undermine the Carter presidency and essentially throw their lot with Ronald Reagan in 1980, who said that he would be much more friendly to the Christian right agenda. So in many ways, Carter does set things off, but it's really the response to Carter, I think, that falls into this kind of narrative that led us to Donald Trump.
You mentioned abortion. Now, it's also the case that the Republicans, like people like Nelson Rockefeller and others in the party, were pro-choice, whereas the Democrats for a period of time were pro-life. And they've since flipped and become very stuck in these positions. Right. So why has abortion been so much at the center of evangelical politics? I mean, why not other Christian principles like helping the poor, for instance?
Sure. Well, the history of abortion, as you've already alluded to, Duncan, is very interesting because, you know, most Republicans, or a good percentage of leading Republicans, including Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, you mentioned Nelson Rockefeller as well, were pro-choice on the issue of abortion. And it was many of the Democrats, especially the Democrats who were Catholic and represented white working class Catholics, even the Kennedy family, Ted Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, even the African-American community was very pro-life. These candidates were all pro-life. Al Gore in the 1970s. But that changed, as you mentioned, and we could go into why that changed and how that changed. I think a lot of it has to do with the way in which the Democratic Party was taken over by those on what we might call the new left, those who were part of the feminist movement, those who wanted to defend the rights of women to choose. That's a whole other story. But it's also interesting that the Southern Baptist Convention, today one of the strongest pro-life factions in the United States, endorsed Roe versus Wade on the basis of the fact that they thought it was good that government was not going to interfere in the moral lives, the reproductive lives of citizens. It's really not until the late 1970s when evangelicals begin to think much more along the lines of Catholic social teaching on this. The Catholics have condemned abortion for centuries. And there was a man, I talk about him in the book, a very popular evangelical intellectual named Francis Schaeffer, who managed to make the case and convince many of the evangelical political leaders that evangelicals should be more concerned with abortion than they actually were. It's really not until the late 1970s that abortion becomes a mainstay of the political platform for the Christian right. There was a great deal of optimism, I think, among the Christian right in the 1980s that if they exercised political power and had appointed the right Supreme Court justices and elected the right people, Roe versus Wade would be overturned and abortion would be outlawed to some extent in the United States. We are now going on about 40 years of that kind of political agenda, and Roe v. Wade has not even come close yet to being overturned. So what I've suggested in the book, that perhaps it's time to for evangelicals who are pro-life and do think that abortion is a horrible thing and that we need to reduce the number of abortions in this country, perhaps it's time for evangelicals to start investing their time and their money into other means by which to reduce the number of abortions, means other than simply electing the right candidates to office. Imagine the millions and millions of dollars that evangelicals spend on political campaigns so that they can elect presidents that will appoint Supreme Court justices to overturn Roe versus Wade. Think about how those millions of dollars could be spent in other ways to whether it be alleviate poverty, whether it's to form more crisis pregnancy centers, whatever it might be, and however you might want to go about that politically and policy-wise, to reduce the number of abortions. But the Christian right is sort of stuck. They really don't know any other way how to do politics. And most of their followers, especially those who came of age during the Christian right era, many of the baby boomers today, know of no other way to think about politics than abortion and maybe one or two other issues.
Right. I want to get into the third theme, which is nostalgia. But one quick question I wanted to ask you is, evangelicals are more likely on average to not believe in human-made climate change. Is there an explanation for that?
Yeah. excuse me. I would probably argue that, well, three things. I'll see if I remember all three of them. One is there is a deep-seated anti-intellectualism within American evangelicalism. And one of the ways in which that anti-intellectualism plays itself out is in the distrust of science. You can trace this all the way back to the 20th century with the Scopes trial and the debate over evolution and so forth. There is just this general distrust of science, especially when science conflicts with their understanding of the Bible. So I think going into the discussion over climate change, this mistrust of science has to be taken into consideration. Not all evangelicals, but there is a significant portion that do because of this kind of anti-intellectual streak. I think secondly, evangelicals are very concerned about environmentalism and climate change because they believe that if evangelicals were to get involved in these issues, it would somehow detract from their primary purpose, which is to be advancing the cause of the gospel and preaching and saving the lost and serving the needy and so forth, which is kind of ironic because I would argue that politics has pulled them away from that mission as well. But they're very concerned about that, that as well, that this is a distraction, these kinds of things. And I said there was a third one, but I can't remember it.
No worries.
Can't remember it right now.
So when we talk about nostalgia, as a historian, do you believe that America was founded as a Christian nation?
Yeah, great question. I wrote a book about this in 2011 with that very title, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? And I think if you were to ask that question sort of without trying to do your best at least to try to not bring contemporary politics into it, it's a very difficult question to answer. In many ways, it's a bad historical question. This idea of was America founded as a Christian nation? Because you're taking a debate that has really only swirled in American political life since the 1980s, and you're taking that debate and then forcing it back on the 18th century world of the founding fathers who were not asking those questions. The founding fathers clearly did not endorse Christianity as any kind of state religion. They instead endorsed religious freedom for all people. They did not endorse anything that was specifically Christian in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. They did think that morality was important to a good republic. And many of the state constitutions that were founded did want to make sure that their governments remained Christian by electing Christian candidates. So it's a very, very complicated question. Now, if you were to ask me, is America a Christian nation today? I think the answer would be certainly no, because any case you can make about the states being Christian was kind of nullified by the 14th Amendment, which essentially said that those in the states now have to conform to the Constitution. And then later on, the Supreme Court ruled that they must conform to the Constitution on matters of religion. So in other words, they can't have a test oath for office and they must afford religious freedom to all people. So I do think, though, the entire Christian right and the entire effort to get Donald Trump elected, ironically, is because of Trump's character flaws, is ironically rooted in the idea that people believe that Donald Trump is the best option for restoring or reclaiming or renewing the Christian America that they believed existed at the time of the founding. It's a nostalgia perhaps a world that never existed in the first place, this idea of Christian America, the founding as a Christian event. So the power of this idea that America was founded as a Christian nation, whether it was or wasn't, is still with us today. And it's been with us for a long time. And it's in many ways shaping how many Christian, evangelical Christian right politicians today think about how to vote and how to engage in public policy.
The last question I wanted to ask you is, this book in many ways, I know it comes from I was going to say this book in many ways is quite critical of evangelicals, but critical in the same way you might criticize a sibling, I suppose.
Right.
Someone that, you know, you have deep love for. Was this difficult for you to write, or were you hoping that perhaps this could provide a way forward for the evangelical community after Trump?
Well, it wasn't very difficult to write. I feel like I wrote out of, some kind of moral conviction, some kind of Christian conviction. There wasn't a time where I think I questioned my own sense of this. I felt like I needed to say something to my fellow evangelicals. And I don't know if I ever wavered on that front. And there hasn't been much that has changed my mind about the argument of the book since the book has come out. There's a few things I might have changed here or there, but nothing about the central argument of the book, those three points of fear, power, and nostalgia. What I did find to be very difficult was I hadn't anticipated the degree to which this book would not change hearts and minds of the strongest Trump supporters. I went into this with the impression that if I just mounted really good arguments, I would win people over, and perhaps a small percentage, I wasn't expecting a lot, but maybe a small percentage of people would turn away from Trump or see that they made a bad choice. And again, I don't know what the readers are thinking about the book, but I'm not sure it's switched that group of voters. I think where it has made some inroads is among many evangelicals who, for lack of a better metaphor, kind of held their nose and voted for Trump. I wanted to give them an argument to say there are Christian reasons not to vote for Donald Trump in 2020. There are Christian reasons why you didn't have to vote for Donald Trump in 2016. I've heard from a lot of people who said sort of things like, thank you for taking me off the hook. Right. I didn't realize that I could stay true to my Christian faith in this way and continue to and not support Donald Trump, because many of these people had been so schooled by that political playbook about how to do politics that came from the Christian right. And I also think the book has been useful, as at least I've heard anecdotally, from those who did not support Donald Trump, but were looking for ways to help them articulate their anti-Trumpism to friends and family members who in the evangelical community who did vote for Donald Trump, give them some resources to think about those things. I don't think I'd do it any other way. The book wasn't particularly difficult to write. But like any author, you would have hoped that perhaps it would have made a bigger dent in some of that 81%. And we'll see what happens in 2020.
Well, I think it certainly has made a dent in some people. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you to John Fia. Thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.